Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Satnam, Sat Sri Akal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanya Wase Yake. Hello, may everything be well with you as it is with me. And now, I will recite, as I do every day before the start of class, the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. So please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you were close who has died. And in doing so, you will honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your own consciousness. Yiskadalvi Shkadash me rabo, Bomo di vero kirase, Vayamlik melkase, Bakayakon, Ubyo makon, Uvkaya de ko, base Yisrael, Baagalo uvisman koriev, Vayimru omein. Ye heish me rabo mavorak, Leolam ole ome omayo, Yisbarak vayistavak, Vayisbarar vayisramam, Vayisnase vayishadar, Vayisale vayishalal, Shmeidu kadjo beraku. Leolo min kol berkoso vesharoso, tushbikoso venekamoso, da amiron beomo, veimru omen. Ye he shlomo rabo min shamayo, vekayim olenu veyal kol Yisrael, veimru omen. O se shalom bimromov, huyashe shalom, olenu veyal kol Yisrael, veimru omen. Thank you very much. And check my mic levels here. Okay, we're good. All right. Well, in our last class, we said that Kabbalah was a stage in the evolution of Jewish mysticism, and we traced that stream of mysticism all the way back to the now lost, having almost mythical status, book of esoteric wisdom titled Sefer Raziel HaMalak, which in English means the Book of Raziel the Angel. This book, as its name indicates, is attributed, its authorship is attributed to Raziel, the archangel associated with Sephira Hukma, which means wisdom. And as we said, the legend has it, the teaching beyond legend, there's more credence given to it than legend, is that the archangel Raziel wrote this book of esoteric wisdom and gave it to Adam and Eve after they were cast out of Gan Eden, as a way for them to be able to perfect themselves so that they could return to their former level of nearness to God. So we traced back through various traditions and various books all the way back to then, Jewish mysticism, leading all the way back to, under this tradition, to Adam and Eve. Today, I want to begin to describe for you the major evolutionary stages of Jewish mysticism. And in doing this, it will put into context, into proper context, where Kabbalah, especially the Kabbalah that is taught today, where it'll put it into the proper context. All right, then. So, Jewish mysticism goes back a long time, but we will begin our discussion with Jewish mysticism at about the earliest time that we can really, with any certainty, go back, because beyond this, we start getting out of recorded history and start moving into myth and legend, as far as historians and scholars are concerned. Or another way of putting it is this is as early as we can go, what I'm going to talk to you about here first, which is around the time of the Second Temple, the end of the Second Temple. It was built around 500 and something before the Common Era, when the Jews returned from their exile in Babylonia. They built a second temple, and it stood from that time period, about 514, I believe, Common Era, until it was destroyed by the Roman armies under Titus's leadership in the year 70 Common Era. So so this is the time period that we're talking about. This is the time period that appears in the Gospels, in the New Testament. And at that time we had, if you remember, in the New Testament, there were various sects of Jews described. There were the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And there was also, and I don't believe these are described in those Gospels, but scholars now know that there was a sect called the Essenes. Essenes. And this was a Jewish sect at the time of the Roman persecution and that sect may have been the same sect that archived the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found in the 1940s in the cliffs in the desert of Israel, at Wadi Qumran, the Qumran sect, which some people attribute to being the Essenes. And just to put this in some sort of perspective for you, the Essenes figure also in Christian Kabbalah, and which is an offshoot of Jewish Kabbalah. All Kabbalah is Jewish at its root. And anything else that came out of it, alchemical Kabbalah, Christian Kabbalah, all of those things are based on Jewish Kabbalah. They are Christian and medieval developments of Jewish Kabbalah. Some would say perversions. I'm not prepared to go that far, especially with respect to alchemy, which essentially deals with the perfection of the human being, which is one of the goals of Kabbalah. In any event, in alchemy, one of the teachings is that Jesus of Nazareth, the so-called Messiah of the Christians, was supposed to have been sent from about his 12th year when he appeared and taught and debated with the elders and the rabbis in the temple, and they discovered that this was a very, very bright young man. Tradition, alchemical tradition, holds that this young Jesus of Nazareth was sent to the Essenes until he was 33 years of age, and he studied there under them. And what did he study? He studied esoteric Jewish mysticism until age 33, when he came out of this cloistered community environment and returned to the mainstream of the Jewish towns, and to Jerusalem, Bethlehem, to these different towns where he taught, that's recorded in the Gospels, and which he did, of course, when he received his ministry, which was after he was baptized by John the Baptist in the River Jordan. And it was said that the Spirit of God came down in the form of a dove, and the clouds opened up and a beam of light shot down, and the Father said, "This is my Son, in him I am greatly pleased." Okay, So tradition has it and the tradition I'm talking about here is alchemical and Christian Kabbalistic tradition has it that Jesus of Nazareth spent 21 years in, which would be three cycles of seven. So think about these numbers. Three cycles of seven. In mystical instruction in the community of the Essene sect. Okay, so the first mystical sect and tradition that we're going to talk about are these Essenes. At this time, mysticism was apocalyptic in nature, and I'm talking about the subject matter with which it dealt. And what it means when we talk about apocalyptic is the apocalypse. It means dealing with what's going to happen when time comes to an end. In other words, the end of the world scenarios. Similar to in the New Testament, the book of John, who wrote the book of Revelation. That's in the Christian perspective. Okay, but at this time, apocalyptic mysticism was in fact what all the Jewish mystics were concerned with. So it's no surprise that this John of biblical times wrote a book that was apocalyptic in nature. What other things were considered besides the apocalypse itself? What other things were the object of mystical inquiry? Well, the structure of heaven, in other words, the nature of Godhead, what worlds existed, what spiritual levels existed, other subjects of spiritual inquiry were Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. What was it? Was it just a spiritual place? Is it a physical place? Does it exist somewhere on earth, but it's been shielded off, cloaked, so to speak, so the humans can't see it under ordinary states of consciousness? And Gehinnom. Gehinnom is the Jewish term for what Christians later named hell. Okay, but in Judaism, the poor souls who end up going there, it's more like a purgatory. They go there to perfect themselves. They don't go there to be tortured by fire and flames, as in the Christian view. Of course, the Jews aren't trying to proselytize. They're not trying to convert people, so they don't have to have a hell. They don't have to say, believe what we say, or your body will die, but your soul will live forever in torment in the flames of... In the flaming lake of hell. Okay, what other things were included in apocalyptic mysticism? That the Essenes adhered to in their belief structures: angels and evil spirits. Also, they delved into the fate of the human soul after death. And a great deal, and this sets the ground for what came next, the throne of glory and the king, meaning God, who occupies it. And one of their great mystical texts, a text that we now know was in the possession of the sect at Qumran, because they have found this, was the mystical book called the Book of Enoch. This is a book attributed to, authorship attributed to, Enoch, the man who was raised up and became the angel Metatron, a Jew way, way, way back in biblical times, who was so righteous that he was raised up off the earth, did not have to experience physical death, and given a spot in the angelic hierarchy of the heavens, and he became the angel Metatron, who alchemists also attribute to being the angel who gave to mystics the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. Okay, so the Book of Enoch is one of the books that was found in the caves of Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. All right, so much for that phase. Then the next phase took off at around the year 100 AD or CE, and lasted for quite a while, but was the major phase of Jewish mysticism, lasting at least until the 5th century AD or Common Era. And this phase generally can be called Jewish rabbinic Gnosticism. Now, that's not my opinion. This is something that Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Kabbalah, says in his book Kabbalah, A Definitive History of the Evolution Ideas Leading Figures, An Extraordinary Influence of Jewish Mysticism, that he published. And so he groups a number of types of mysticism at this time under a catch-all category title, which he calls Jewish Rabbinic Gnosticism. And he calls it this because these things roughly paralleled the Gnosticism that was taking place at the time among Christians in the same period. And what is Gnosticism? Gnosticism roughly means the study of secret knowledge. And it's represented on the Christian side in the ancient texts that were discovered. I can't remember exactly when they were discovered, but these were a bunch of scrolls that were discovered in jars in a cave in Egypt that later came to be known as the Nag Hammadi Library. And most of these are, a lot of these are Gospels written of the life of this Jesus of Nazareth. But they were banned by the early Christian church as being heretical. In fact, it was after sometime around, not sure if it was 430, the year 430, but it was around that time that they had a great council, a council of Nicaea, and it was decided what the Christian canon of canonical texts, what was going to be included in the so-called New Testament and what was going to be excluded. Because at that time, many, many different sects of Christianity existed. And not all of these were like the Christianity described in the first four Gospels of the New Testament, or even in the Christianity described by the books attributed to the authorship of St. Paul. There were many of these sects that believed in a Jesus who was a mystical teacher, not necessarily a Messiah, but a great mystical teacher. Or if he was a Messiah, he was a Messiah, what would be along Jewish lines, or called a Messiah ben Joseph, a great avatar, a teacher who is sent by God to reveal the nature of God and the unreality of life, to preach a gospel of illusion and enlightenment. And the church fathers at the time who gained the upper hand were against all those things. And so they declared them to be heresy and said they could not be included in the church canon of the Christian church. And so they were barred and banned. And as many copies that they could get their hands on were burned. And those sects who practiced and taught it were excommunicated, and in many cases their leaders and teachers were assassinated and hunted down, persecuted, driven underground. Same old story in every religion. Nothing unusual here. So this is what was going on at the time in Christianity. Well, at the same time, there was a form of Jewish Gnosticism that was going on, the study of secret knowledge. In other words, you had the written Torah that set forth the five books of Moses that had all the laws, and then you had the written books of wisdom, and you had the written books of prophecy of the prophets. And people had been studying these for centuries. But suddenly, at this time, there was an eruption, if you will, of interest in mystical things and a search for hidden wisdom, hidden knowledge that described God, God's emergence in the world, and God's relationship with mankind in different terms and from different perspectives, from the mystical perspective. And this had some influence on Christian Gnosticism, probably had the most influence on Christian Gnosticism, but just like light that is emitted from the sun bounces off the moon, well, some of it bounces back toward the sun, is reabsorbed in the sun in the form of energy. The same thing happened here. So even though Christian Gnosticism had its roots in Jewish Gnosticism and therefore was mostly Jewish in nature, it developed once it became its own separate branch. Once it forked off the Jewish stream of mysticism, it began to develop along its own lines, and changes started to occur in it. Well, then the Jews at the time who were practicing Jewish Gnosticism picked up off of pieces of it, and the reflection of those changes came back to them, and they incorporated some of those changes. So there's give and take between different streams of mysticism, influence back and forth. Okay. The greatest form, the most prevalent form that this Jewish rabbinic Gnosticism took is what's known as Merkabah mysticism. And that's what I'll spend the rest of today's teaching on, is Merkabah mysticism. Now, what is it? Merkabah, first of all, is Hebrew for the word chariot. So this literally means chariot mysticism. And it's based on the prophet Ezekiel's vision that's set down in the first chapter of the book of Ezekiel. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read that chapter, and then I'm going to comment as I read it. I'm going to make comments that I find appropriate to it. Not that mine are the only comments appropriate to it, mind you. Every teacher can read every piece of scripture and have different comments, all of which are valid. That's the nature of mysticism, folks. All right, first chapter of the book of Ezekiel. This is the great vision that Ezekiel had. And he begins in verse 1. And it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, and all these numbers are Kabbalistically important, but I won't get into that. As I was among the exiles by the Kevar River, now this is Ezekiel recording what happened, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. And I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came from the north, a great cloud, and a fire flaring up, and a brightness was around, out of its midst, as the color of amber, that's a yellow color, out of the midst of the fire. Now, I'll make some comments on this verse. The north is the direction from which purification always comes in most mystical systems. It's from the north that purification comes in Native American mythology, in their religious systems. It's the direction from which winter comes. And what does winter do? It destroys all life temporarily. It kills everything. temporarily. It purges the earth of all of its life. And then in the spring, everything has to start over. So the north is the direction that Ezekiel saw this stormy wind coming. And he saw a great cloud and a fire flaring up and brightness around it. And out of the midst of the fire was a color as of amber. North is the direction that awesome, terrifying things always come from. It's you see something coming from the north, especially a storm, you know that it's not going to be good. The north wind is always the worst wind. Also note that God appeared to the Israelites at the base of Mount Sinai, in the theophany there to Moses, and in the giving of the covenant of the Torah to the Israelites. He appeared to them in the form of a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So here's this same symbolism. And he led them through the wilderness for 40 years. He went ahead of the company of Israel in the form of a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Verse 5, also out of its midst came the likeness of four living creatures. The word for living creatures here in the Hebrew is chayot. Okay, chaya would be singular. Chayot is living. Etz chayim, the tree of life. Chayot, same root. Okay, so out of the midst of this cloud, this fiery cloud, came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. Well, now in this regard, they don't have the likeness of men, not ordinary men. These are the likeness of angels, aren't they? And these particular angels had four faces and four wings. Okay? And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot. And they sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. Verse 8, and they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. And the four had their faces and their wings thus. And now it's going to describe how their wings were. Their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went everywhere straight forward. Okay, so what this is saying is that the wings of these living creatures, these angels, called chayot. Okay? This is a category of angels now that's being established here in the book of Ezekiel, based on his vision. This is the source of some of these categories of angels, is this vision in the first chapter of Ezekiel. Okay? These wings that they had were fixed. Each one of them had four wings. Two of the wings they had went in at 90 degree angles horizontally, and they were joined to meet the wings of the others. So these four angelic beings formed, if you will, like four posts, and joining those four posts were two of each of those angels' wings. So they formed a sort of frame or a box, and this is the body. This is how we can extrapolate that to be the body of the chariot. All right. Now, chapter 1, verse 10. Ezekiel tells us, as for the likeness of their faces, the four living beings, angels, had the face of a man and the face of a lion on the right side, and the four had the face of an ox on the left side. The four also had the face of an eagle. So, they had, each one of these beings had four faces. They had the face of a man. Only one was the face of a man. The other three were faces of animals, beasts. Face of a man, the face of a lion, the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. Those beings figure again in the Bible in another one of the prophets. And I don't want to say for sure, but I believe it's the book of Daniel, and it's apocalyptic literature. So this is apocalyptic literature. This is all the same time period where the apocalyptic literature is flowing into the Hekhelot literature, which means literature of the palaces, which is based on all on this vision of the chariot, which I'll explain coming up here in a few minutes. Okay, so you'll see those same beasts. The man, the lion, the ox, and the eagle. Okay, these four faces, the number four here represents a lot of different things, symbolically and metaphorically and archetypally. Among the things it represents are the four seasons and the four cardinal directions. And indeed, that's the way the faces are arranged. They have these angels, these coyote, have bodies that are like bronze, but in the shape of a man. And on the head, on one side, there's four sides to the head, and on each side is a different face. And they're arranged cardinally, like the four directions on the compass or on a map. Okay, verse 11. Thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. Okay, so four wings, two of which were joined to the wings of every other one, and two of which were covering their bodies. Verse 12 and 13. And they went every one straight forward. Where the Spirit would go, they went. And they turned not when they went. That means that they were fixed in their position. That even though the chariot moved forward or the chariot turned, they did not turn and face different directions. They were fixed. They always went straight forward. As for the likeness of the living creatures, the coyote, these angels, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of torches, it flashed up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and from the fire went forth lightning. Now I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this subject right here. This lightning it's talking about here, it's the highest class of angels known as the seraphim. They provide the energy that's moving this chariot. And they determine its direction. How do they determine its direction? Well, they don't actually make the decision, but they convey that decision. Why? Because they're flashing up and down between from the heads of the coyote, the living beings, the angels, up to what's above, which hasn't been described yet. But I'll just tell you, there's a throne, and sitting on this throne is God. So these flashes of light, these lightning flashes, are going up, getting directions from God, and then coming back down and bringing that direction and providing the energy to carry it out, those movements, and all the way down to the feet of the living beings, the angels called coyote, and transferring that energy into the wheels that you'll see in a moment are attached there, called the ophanim, which is the lowest class of angels. Okay, verse 14. And the living creatures ran and returned like the appearance of a flash of lightning. Okay, what does it mean, ran and returned like the appearance of a flash of lightning? Well, slow motion photography, if you've ever looked at lightning strikes, and you can go online and Google this, and you can find this. Slow motion photography shows that lightning, when it takes place, that the light energy moves from the clouds to the earth. And so you see this flash, and you can see this with the naked eye. You can see the part come down. You can see the lightning go down. But what you can't see, unless you have a slow motion camera, is the light returning from the ground to the cloud. So it isn't just a one-way thing. There's a light flash down and a return flash back up. So it actually bounces off the ground and comes back up. And actually, I believe scientifically, it occurs a bunch of times. It goes back and forth. cloud to ground to cloud to ground to cloud to ground until the energy is dissipated. Okay, so here we have in these days of Ezekiel, way back in the Bible, we have a prophet describing lightning flashes that ran and returned, or the movement of these chayot, these living angels, these living creatures, these living beings, these angels, says that they moved, that they ran and returned like the appearance of a flash of lightning. Well, this is before science revealed this, but it was obviously known somehow. So we have that aspect of this phrase. And so that's what the running and returning means. But here's something that's really interesting to me. That is this phrase, ran and returned, and the appearance of lightning. This is verbatim the same as found in a book I mentioned yesterday. That's the Sefer Yetzirah, the book attributed to Abraham. In chapter 1, verse 6, we have this quote in poetic form. 10 sephirot of nothingness. Their vision is like the appearance of lightning. Their limit has no end. And his word in them is running and returning. They rush to him, to his saying, like a whirlwind. And before his throne, they prostrate themselves. So here we have 10 sephirot of nothingness. Their vision is like the appearance of lightning. And their limit has no end, and his word in them is running and returning. Appearance of lightning and running and returning. There it is, exactly what we just read in Ezekiel. It would be interesting to know. Well, obviously, Ezekiel came after Abraham. So Ezekiel saw something that put him directly in mind of what he had already read, most likely, in the mystical text called Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Formation. What does this mean, though? What does this mean? What it means is that our vision of the 10 holy sephirot, which is the Godhead, it's the 10 stages by which God descended into the world, by which God went from being transcendent and totally spiritual into becoming and impersonal, into becoming a personal God who we can perceive. But the form in which we perceive God is in the form of the 10 holy sephirot in the diagram of Etz Chaim, the holy tree of life, the tree of life. And so what this passage here means, that this running and returning, having the appearance of lightning, is how long can you look at a piece of lightning, a flash of lightning? It's over with just, you know, the snap of a finger. You can't see it very long before it's gone. Well, the mind is not capable of remaining in the state of consciousness necessary to view the 10 sephirot. That state of consciousness is called by the mystics Chokhmah consciousness. Why? Because it's associated with the sephirah Chokhmah, which is the topmost sephirah that we are capable of entering into with our human, limited human intellects. We can't enter into Keter consciousness, because that would involve the destruction of the human ego. We would not return from that. Or at least, no one in my experience has entered into Keter consciousness and returned. We can only hope to attain to the level of Sephirah Chokhmah, where you can look down upon the other eight sephirot. Okay, this state of consciousness is nonverbal. We enter into it momentarily, but then we lose our concentration and we're pulled back into what's called Binah consciousness, the next layer or level down. That's the normal state of our minds. It's a state of mind in which all our thoughts are verbal. Yes, we see things, but what does our mind immediately do? It instantly puts words to it. We think. We think with words, verbally. Okay, so our normal state of consciousness is Binah consciousness. That's verbal consciousness. What we try to do is rise up into that higher level of Hakma consciousness, which is nonverbal, where words don't exist, where we just have pure experience, where we can see things with our spiritual mind's eye. And what it means by running and returning is we force ourselves through concentration methods to rise up to there, and then we can't remain there very long because our powers of concentration are limited, and we return to the lower level of Mana consciousness. Now, Rabbi Moses de Leon, the publisher of the Zohar, which is the foundational text of modern Kabbalah. All right, and he published it. He was a Spanish Kabbalist who taught at the end of the 1295, about when that came out, when he redacted it and published it in written manuscript form. At the end of the 13th century. He described Hakma consciousness as the light reflected off the surface of a bowl of water onto a wall. Oh, I just love this description. Think about this. Think about having a bowl of water sitting on a table, having the light of the sun come in and reflect off of the surface of that bowl of water. And its reflection goes up and appears on the wall. We've all seen something like that. And if we haven't, I'm asking you, if you haven't, go tomorrow. If you have the sun come out, the first day you have the sun come out, go get a bowl of water and do this experiment. Set it where that sun comes through your window or even outside on a patio and reflects off of it and bounces off the surface of the water and hits on the wall. It's going to be one of the most beautiful things you can look at. And you're going to see what happens. When that first happens, you can see that reflection very clearly. But it's only momentary, because at the very least disturbance, just something vibrate that table just a little bit, or just a breath of air vibrate the surface of the water, the reflection on the wall moves wildly about and breaks up. This is our common experience when we meditate on the 10 Holy Sephirot. Just as we obtain a glimpse of this higher world, we lose it. Almost the second we see it, and we're there, we lose it, and we're pulled back down into the lower world of Bina consciousness, ordinary consciousness. It's frustrating. It's a very frustrating thing, but when you get that glimpse, it is so fulfilling that you'll always be working on getting it again. Okay, getting back to the text, the foundational text of Merkava mysticism, which is chapter 1, Ezekiel's vision. Verse 15 and 16, he says, "And as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels, Ophanim, the lowest level of angels in this vision." Okay, that's not him saying this. That's an aside that a comment I put in here. I'll read this 16 and then make the comment. "The appearance of the wheels and their work was like the color of an emerald. And the four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Cognizant of the time here, I'm going to make my comment on this verse, and then we'll wrap it up for today and continue on tomorrow. Okay, so now he's talking about the wheels that are connected to the feet of the Chayat, the living creatures, the angels in the middle. And he calls these wheels, the word he uses is Ophanim, and this is the lowest level of angels now that you'll see in this vision. And he says that their work was like the color of an emerald, and the four had one likeness. That means they were all the same. And their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, it means that there's a hub and a rim. That's one can interpret it on the surface, but we're, as I talked about yesterday, we're required to go beyond the surface and interpret the deeper levels, the mysteries, the secrets. of the scriptures. The ten holy sephirot were originally emanated by God in concentric circles. That's right, they didn't take on the form of the Etz Chaim, the form of a tree, or the form of a man. They didn't have that form. They were originally emanated in the form of ten concentric circles. So this parallels that, concentric circles. This also symbolizes the concept of integration of the microcosm, which is man, the smaller circle, which is enclosed in the macrocosm, God. All right. That's all the more that I'm going to teach on today, because otherwise it's just too much of a burden upon you to attend these classes, because I could go on and on. But I'm going to try to keep these to 45 minutes or less, and more preferably around 35 minutes. So that concludes today's teaching. It will be rebroadcast tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Today's Wednesday, so we'll continue on in this discussion of Ezekiel's vision and how it became the foundation of Merkava and Hekalot mysticism when we continue next Monday at the same time. So between now and then, don't forget to remember God at least twice a day. And until we meet again, may you go from strength to strength and be well. Zeigesund.